You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
On a night when we will be discussing a decade in which the issues of free speech and freedom of expression were catapulted into the forefront of public life, I want to be sure that we all take notice that it is a small independent bookstore that is sponsoring this event. In a time of media consolidation and homogenous chain stores, independent bookstores are a bright point of enlightenment, if you will. We are dedicated to reflecting our own unique community. We offer a venue for public conversation, and we believe in the importance of diversity and accessibility of printed materials. Capitola Book Cafe thanks all of you for your support, and we strongly encourage you to visit us at our store year-round, as well as joining us for such exciting off-site events as tonight. Tom Brokaw has been a keen observer of national and world events for almost 50 years. With his direct yet thoughtful manner, his tireless attention to detail, and his completely unflappable presentation, he has become a deeply respected translator of events that truly affect our lives. He was in the American South to witness the violence that came as the struggles for civil rights grew. He was on the Hate at Ashbury, dressed in a suit and a tie, talking with the flower children who offered him a joint. He has reported across the world from Iraq, Afghanistan, and Tibet to Jackson, Mississippi. He was even at the Berlin Wall the night it was hammered down. Tom Brokaw covered every U.S. presidential election since 1968, anchored NBC Nightly News for 20 years, and wrote the best-selling book, The Greatest Generation, just to mention a few stops on his unmatched journey. His new work, Boom, Voices of the 60s, is a candid look back at the tumultuous time that rocked the country, a decade so powerful that we feel its aftershocks today. Bookending the 60s with the assassination of John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon's resignation as president, Tom Brokaw leaps back into the issues of the day, talking with the pronounced leaders and the quieter participants, and rekindling the fires that ignited the nation: racial inequality, poverty, women's rights, environmentalism, the drug culture, freedom of speech, and of course, the Vietnam War. Tom Brokaw was on the front line as the country fell apart then. And now, 40 years later, he is in the unique and fascinating position to call upon the movers and shakers and ask them about the 60s. What happened? Why? Was it good? What was lost? How did it change us? How did it change the nation? Boom includes interviews with people ranging from Gloria Steinem to Pat Buchanan to cartoonist Gary Trudeau. Boom also includes the honest commentary and probing questions of Mr. Brokaw himself. He insists that we examine time past, even though the conclusions are murky. He also demands that we take a hard look at our country today, since even in Santa Cruz, the 60s are over. Even in Santa Cruz, the 60s are over, and we all must be participants in the here and the now. Please welcome Tom Brokaw.
Thank you. Trust me, before the evening is over, you'll get over it. I'm stunned. The 60s are over in Santa Cruz? What am I doing here? I came to Santa Cruz in 1967 to cover the Board of Regents meeting at the University of California at Santa Cruz and saw Ronald Reagan walk a gauntlet of students. There he was in his full Hollywood suit, licking every inch. Ronald Reagan, the man who later became two terms as President of the United States, followed by his security phalanx. And then the students, sandaled, long hair, peasant dresses, bell-bottom trousers, smoking joints, and yelling at him. And I thought, this is where America is now. It was, in many ways, in 1967, just the overture of what was to come. Ronald Reagan was a product of the Great Depression in the Midwest, came out to live the American dream in California after having been a broadcaster in Iowa, then a B-movie star. His career kind of flattened out. He went on the General Electric lecture circuit, went from being an FDR Democrat to a Goldwater Republican, got involved in politics, ran for governor of California in 1966. I just joined NBC as a 26-year-old, and they said, "You're the new kid. This actor's going nowhere. Why don't you go on and cover him?" So I did. And he was elected by a very substantial margin in the fall of that year, and it began really a historic political career. At the same time, however, there were other seismic shifts going on across America, but especially here in California. 40 years ago was the summer of love. That's when I went to Haight-Ashbury looking like a narc. I had come from a demonstration at Berkeley covering the free speech movement and the firing of Clark Kerr, and I was in my correspondence uniform of a trench coat and a button-down shirt and a narrow tie. And the cabbie said, "What do you do, mister?" And I said, "I'm a journalist." He said, "You're not going to believe what's going on out in this neighborhood called Haight-Ashbury." And I said, "Well, let's go." So we went. And it was as close to the bar scene in Star Wars as any place I have ever been. It was very friendly. They not only offered me a joint, but handfuls of tabs of acid and anything that I wanted, and I kind of staggered out of there. Went back, true story, heard a little of Ella Fitzgerald at the Fairmont Hotel. Got up the next morning, called the Today Show, and said, "I think I have a story for us out here in San Francisco." That was 1967. 1968, boom. Gene McCarthy decides to challenge the sitting president in his own party and goes to New Hampshire to run against the war in Vietnam. And boom, he comes within 7 points of beating Lyndon Johnson, who had crushed Barry Goldwater just 4 years earlier. 2 months later, boom, the Tet Offensive happens in Vietnam. The Viet Cong invade the American embassy in Saigon. Now think about the Al-Qaeda going into the green zone now and invading the American embassy in Baghdad or in Kabul, what the reaction of the country would be. It was an enormous psychological victory for the VC. In purely military terms, they lost much more than they gained, but it rattled this country and it fed a growing ambivalence about the wisdom of the war. Bobby Kennedy, boom, decides that he's going to run for president of the United States. He'd been the tough, even ruthless little brother of the martyr president who had died in an assassin's bullet in 1963, which I believe was the beginning of the 1960s. That's when the 50s innocence came to an end, and all the youthful idealism that John Kennedy seemed to symbolize for us was taken from us. Bobby Kennedy gets in. Martin Luther King, meanwhile, is trying to hang on to the civil rights campaign that he had so persuasively started with such eloquence and moral passion in the Deep South in the earlier part of the 1960s. But by 1968, there was a new movement within the civil rights campaign called Black Power. H. Rapp Brown and Stokely Carmichael were raising their fists and saying, we'll deal with violence. Dr. King had the Poor People's Crusade underway with a big camp out on the wall in Washington, and he was going to Memphis, Tennessee, against the advice of most of his principal aides, to represent the striking sanitation workers. He made an eloquent speech the night before his appearance, talking about having seen the promised land. And the next night he went out onto the balcony of the Lorraine Hotel, and he was shot through the neck and killed. And across America, in the black community, rage erupted, understandably. People couldn't believe that this great moral leader, who will stand the test of time, in my judgment, forever, as one of the great figures, not just of this country, but of the world, with Gandhi-like stature, was gone. Except in Indianapolis, where Bobby Kennedy had arrived to campaign and gotten the word before the black community did, and stood before them with a single light on him and announced that Martin Luther King was gone. He quoted Greek poets and talked about the loss of his own brother and said there is no answer in rage. And in Indianapolis that night, they did not riot. They went back to their homes to grieve. And in June, Bobby Kennedy, having won California primary in a spirited battle against Gene McCarthy, said the Ambassador Hotel from the podium on to Chicago. 5 minutes later, he was effectively dead. Boom. The world seemed, in this country, to be coming apart in our very hands, wherever you lived, whatever you believed, whatever your hopes were. What kind of country were we? It was just the beginning. Chicago, August 1968. The great Democratic coalition that had been put together by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, that consisted of Southern Democrats, Northern urban Catholics, and labor unions, unraveled in the streets of Chicago. On the campus at Columbia University, a young man by the name of Mark Rudd, who was a devotee of Che Guevara, shut down the campus and threw the president out of his office. Wouldn't let other students go to school because he said Columbia was part of the defense machinery, was fueling the war in Vietnam. 2 years later, he was founder of a group called the Weathermen. And he stood before a microphone and said the 60s were about activism, the 70s were about violent revolution. Three of his friends were killed in a bomb factory in Greenwich Village where they were making bombs to attack the institutions of this country. Fall of 1968, George Wallace, deeply segregationist governor of Alabama, is in the race for president and has a very considerable following. But guess who else is in the race? Richard Milhouse Nixon. In 1962, he had lost in California to Pat Brown and said, you won't have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore. Now, 6 years later, he's a Republican candidate for president of the United States and favored to win, and does, narrowly over Hubert Humphrey, because most of the student activists refused to back Humphrey. And those young men and women who are now in their mid and late 50s say, what were we thinking? And Richard Nixon won and went to the country and said, I remember a sign as I was campaigning. A young man held it up and it said, bring us together, and that is my vow. No promise in American political life has been so famously unfulfilled as Richard Nixon promising to bring us together. In late December, three astronauts climbed aboard a space capsule perched on top of a Saturn rocket. Jim Lovell was one of them, and I spent time with him recently in Chicago. He said we were oblivious to what was going on in this country because we were so focused on the mission. We were worried the Russians were going to get to the moon and circumnavigate it before we did. Our original plan was just to try to do a high-velocity orbit of the Earth, test the spaceship, and then next year try to go to the moon. But we decided that we would have to short-circuit those plans and make the launch. And he said, I got out to Cape Canaveral. I got up on the gantry to get into the space capsule. Fred Hayes and Jim Borman are already in there. It's pitch dark at this point. It's about 4 o'clock in the morning. He said, I look down the road and here come the press cars. And I thought to myself, my God, they're serious. I'm going to the moon. They did a fast orbit and they launched for the first time to the moon. And they got to where they thought they should be and they couldn't see anything except an inky void. And they said, Houston, we're here. Where's the moon? And Houston tilted over the spacecraft. And these three astronauts were looking at the backside of the moon, first time man had ever set sight on that. They rushed to the windows like children at a candy store, put down the flight plan, and just stared at this very gray surface. We always think of it as kind of a romantic yellow-orange orbit up there, but in fact, it's very gray and dusty. And as they're watching it slide by the windows of their space capsule, they emerge from the far side of the moon. And there, in total darkness, is the most beautiful sight they could possibly have imagined that no one had ever seen before. It was the Earthrise. It was this precious planet that we all occupy. Delicate filigree of white clouds, deep blue oceans, and the rust-colored sands of the Sahara, and the deep green of the wilderness areas. And as Jim said, we were in utter awe, realizing that's the spaceship for all of us. That's where we live. That's what will get us into the future. And I put my thumb up, and it covered the whole Earth from that distance. And it gave me perspective that I have today. And then they did something quite remarkable. One of the NASA public relations persons had contacted a friend of his in Washington by the name of Joe Layton. He's an old newspaper man that went into government and survived a lot of different administrations because he was so clever and he was so honest and he always knew what was going on. We all used him as a source at one time or another, and the NASA public relations man said to Joe, think of something for these guys to say. Christmas Eve, coming around the moon, what are they going to say? Joe stayed up late one night. Early in the morning, his wife found him still at the desk, and she said, what's happened? He said, I'm trying to think of something for them to say. She said, read from Genesis. And in the beginning, God created Earth. And he saw that it was good. And so they read from Genesis. And back here, there was a kind of collective sigh of relief. Maybe there is some hope. Troubles were not over by any means. The war was still raging, and it would go on for far too long. The counterculture was tearing apart families. A drug culture was taking root. But at the same time, boom, black young men and women who had been confined to the worst kinds of schools and ghetto neighborhoods in the South and also in the industrial North were seeing opportunities that their families never could have realized before, to go to college, to compete for the good jobs, to move out of those neighborhoods and into integrated neighborhoods. women began to think, I don't have to be the one who stands in the kitchen and does the dishes every night and prepares the meals. A fist just went up higher down here on the... In 1968, you may remember this, it wasn't happening yet. In the anti-war movement, women were treated clerically. Go get the coffee, go get the sandwiches, and I can say this in the Santa Cruz audience, H. Rapp Brown said the only position for women is prone. That's what they were thinking. But by 1972, that was beginning to change. Gloria Steinem and the great godmother of the feminist movement, in my judgment, Betty Friedan, who'd written The Feminine Mystique and given voice to a lot of women out there. But Richard Nixon and the Republican Party knew how to drive a wedge through the Democrats, who were still engaged in internecine warfare in 72, having nominated George McGovern, who now tells me in the book, he said, you know, I've grown up with George McGovern. I've known him all my life. I grew up in South Dakota, after all. And he said, how could they have thought that I was some wild-eyed radical? I'd gotten elected from South Dakota, but I let the excessive elements of a campaign really become the image, the symbol, if you will, of my own drive for the White House. And Robert Novak has written recently, Novak was the man who put in his column that a politician in Washington had said, if George McGovern gets the nomination, it'll all be about acid, abortion, and amnesty for draft evaders. And we didn't know who that was, and a lot of people accused Novak of making it up. And in his book, The Prince of Darkness, he reveals for the first time that it was Tom Eagleton who became McGovern's vice presidential candidate and forgot to tell him that he'd been treated with shock treatments for depression and set the campaign back. So there was great chaos going on in American politics. I like to summarize, if you will, the convulsive change that was going on in this country in a kind of familial way. Imagine a World War II veteran who had survived the Depression and was an eighth grade dropout and joined the Marines and landed in Iwo and went on to fight in Okinawa and came back home and got a good job in Detroit, the Ford Motor Company, when they could still deliver on pensions and good benefits and health care. And he said to his children, you're going to be the first ones in this family to go to college. And he comes home one night for what we called supper in those days, the 5:30 meal, so they could watch Huntley Brinkley together. These are things that don't happen anymore. He sits down at the supper table, and he looks up, and there is his daughter, who's 20 years old, hair on her legs. She hasn't shampooed in 2 weeks. She's holding hands with a greaser, a guy that she's met somewhere, he's not sure where. And she says, Daddy, we're moving in together. Don't worry about it, I'm on the pill. He now looks for relief from his son, who's sitting there with even longer hair and love beads around his forehead and a T-shirt made out of the American flag with a swastika on it, describing to this Marine veteran how he's going to get out of the draft, and if he doesn't, he's going to move to Canada. That's what was going on in this country. There was this enormous clash of cultures and this convulsive change. And the young people had the opportunity to do it in part because of the great sacrifices of their parents, the greatest generation, and also because the economy was different. There was more disposable income in those days. Jan Wenner, who's the founder of Rolling Stone, when I talked to him about the early days at Berkeley, he said, well, you went down to the post office at the end of the week and got a check from your parents. You could live that way. You didn't come out of college with a mountain of debt, for example. And if you got a job, and you did reasonably well, by the time you were 29 or 30, you could put a down payment down on a house that cost maybe $40,000. That would be a good house. And you could think about going for, and it wasn't a subprime loan, by the way. You had to qualify for this one. So there was so much opportunity and flexibility and so many chances that young people could take. The problem is that too many of them took those chances too far. And their adult supervisors and institutions at academies and other places were like deer caught in the headlamps. They were kind of romanced by it all. They knew that they should be saying something about going too far, but they didn't. And as a result, too many of the young people at that time, as they now say, Carl Pope, who is the head of the Sierra Club here in California, is a very thoughtful man, kind of a philosopher of that era, says, in effect, we had tactics, we didn't have strategy. He describes stopping Robert McNamara as he came out of a lecture hall at Harvard in 66, and they surround his limousine, and they won't let him move. And McNamara gets out of the car angry and he says, okay, let's debate the war right here. And Carl said, we didn't have anybody to debate him. We'd only thought about stopping the car. My friend Roger Rosenblatt, who was a professor at Harvard at the time, we've talked about this era, you see him often on public broadcast, he was a junior faculty member. He said, I don't blame the students. I blame the grown-ups for not stepping up and saying, some change is required. Some of the ideas are valid. We can change these institutions for the better. We're going to begin to treat you like grown-ups if you act like grown-ups. But we, too, have a role in all of that. But what was also going on during that time was this remarkable, fertile period in music. Stop and think about the soundtrack of the 60s. It's still with us today. A young woman just interviewed me upstairs. She's maybe 24 years old, I'm not sure. And I said, well, do you still love the music of the 60s? She said, of course. Well, it's 40 years old. That's the most enduring part of it. You can still put on Joni Mitchell, the Buffalo Springfield, Neil Young, the Beatles, Dylan, and it takes you right back, and you feel contemporary. But let me tell you about... Well, maybe not entirely contemporary. Listen, I was on the Today Show the other day with Chris Brown, the little young rapper. There's a picture of him now, of the two of us on the YouTube, and it's kind of, guess which one is the rapper, not hard. Kris Kristofferson, who I've always loved as an artist and as a genuine American figure, grew up in Southern California. His father was an officer during World War II in the Army. Kris Kristofferson was a Rhodes Scholar and the Golden Gloves boxing champion here in California, and a little All-American football player. He was an Army Ranger. Vietnam broke out, and he was getting out of the Army. They wanted him to teach at West Point. But he was in Nashville, but he was thinking about reactivating to go to Vietnam until his fellow Army Rangers said to him, this war is more screwed up than Korea was. They'd been around for a while at that point. And if you see the picture of him then, crew cut Army uniform, you wouldn't believe it's Kris Kristofferson. And that year he did a 180, as he describes it. By the end of that year, he was the Kris Kristofferson that we know today. At the same time, in 1968, a young man was graduating from the Naval Academy by the name of James Webb. He wanted to be a Marine combat leader, graduated first in his class in combat training. He went to Vietnam in 1969 and became one of the most heavily decorated Marines of that war and believed in it because he intellectually had studied it very carefully. And came back from the war, having been wounded several times, and his best friend had lost his arm, and he enrolled in the Georgetown Law School. And the law professor put in the test at the end of his freshman year a war crime, a heinous war crime, and used Webb's name in the test. Jim was so shattered by that when he read it that night, when he took the test home to write the report, that he went in the next day and he braced him. And he said, I lost too many friends in Vietnam for you to do that to me. One of my very closest friends was a Marine flyer in 1968 in Vietnam. We'd grown up in South Dakota together. He was a working class kid who went 101st Airborne right out of high school to make money to go to college. Banged up his knee after a couple of years jumping out of airplanes, came to the university, got a master's degree in political science. I was a political science student as well, but we both kind of ran the student newspaper. And when he graduated, he called me and he said, do you know any Marine recruiters who will kind of overlook my knee because I want to fly planes? And he flew 101 combat missions in Vietnam in 66, 67, burned up on the flight line, came back. I went down to see him at Camp Pendleton. His wife was my wife's college roommate. We were very close. And I said, don't go back. This war is coming apart at the seams, it seems to me. And he had grave doubts about its execution. He said, you know what? I dodged the bullet the first time. I'm going to be okay. We buried him in October of 1968 in South Dakota on a beautiful, beautiful autumnal day. I'd come from California where the war was all around us in so many ways. But there in the Great Plains, they have a more stoic way of looking at life. There was a kind of muted grieving going on. It was not nearly as passionate as it was in California. And I began to have a keener appreciation of the checkerboard of this country and where we were. And so through the rest of the 60s and then into the 70s, we began to work our way through that convulsive time. And then we were confronted with, I think, the greatest constitutional crisis in the history of the country called Watergate. I was a White House correspondent during that time. Richard Nixon dragged this country through a terribly painful period. Some question about whether we could survive that, but we did. Now, fast forward, it's 2007. Life has changed profoundly in the last 40 years. In good ways, but also in bad ways. There's a residue of the 60s that we have to deal with. But let's begin with the good ways. People of color in this country live entirely different lives than they did 40 years ago, have so many more opportunities. We have a young man of very mixed ancestry, but he is a true African American, who is a leading candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination. We have a woman was a pure product of the 60s. Hillary Clinton's commencement speech at Wellesley in 1969 was considered to be a counterculture classic of the time and is now leading in the national polls. And Newt Gingrich no less believes she'll get the nomination, has a very good chance of getting elected. On the Republican side, we have products of first the Nixon and then the Reagan Revolution who are running, people who grew out of that petri dish, if you will, of American politics. I'll leave it to you to fill in those blanks. But, we have something else. We now have an all-volunteer army fighting another deeply divisive war against an insurgency in a country where we're not entirely welcome, where we don't speak the language, and the enemy doesn't hesitate to seek sanctuary in sanctified places or in civilian homes and use their own bodies as instruments. I go to Walter Reed on personal visits, and when I go from room to room to room, I always check the name and the hometown. It's almost always a hometown you've never heard of, tucked away in the piney woods of the South, or the flinty hills of New England, or the rich prairie dirt of the Great Plains where I come from. Or their kids from the barrios in Los Angeles or the working class neighborhoods of Detroit. Their parents are sitting there and they're almost always working class, only high school education. Proud but bewildered, angry some of them. While the rest of us, nothing is being asked of us. No sacrifices. Our children don't have to go to war if they choose not to. They're going to be okay. And you can't have a democratic republic in which you have a society bifurcated between those in uniform and those not, with no connective tissue. So however you feel about the war, I say these days, one of the legacies of the 60s should be that we have to learn that you can hate the war and be furious about the policies that got us involved, but you've got to honor the families. And they have to know that you're there for them. There are fellow citizens. And people say to me, especially those from the 60s, Lawrence Kasdan, who directed and wrote The Big Chill, kind of one of the iconic films of the 60s. I talked to him. He's in the book. I said, how do you feel about Iraq? He said, I go to these dinner parties in Beverly Hills on Saturday nights, and we just rage against the war. And at the end, I go and get my Mercedes and drive to my big house and worry about getting my kids into the right schools. That's kind of where we are. So one of the things that I've been saying is that if you came out of the 60s, or if you're wondering about that time, and you wonder how to reconnect to it in some way, the passions of that time, not to embrace all the positions that we're taking. You can be Republican, Democrat, Libertarian. You can live anywhere in this country. But if you want to look at the 60s and measure it against now, in the 60s, there were real passions across the board, right to left and back again. All the nerve endings in the political arena and in the public arena beyond politics were exposed. And people talked about it every night when they got home, or argued about it at work or on the college campuses. There was a kind of dynamic in our society that has drained away collectively. There are still demonstrations and people standing up and being very unhappy against the war, but by and large, we're standing by. So one of the things that I have learned in writing this book, relearned, I suppose, because it's always coursed through me as a journalist, is that we cannot let our enlistment as citizens run out. We have to constantly renew and re-up. When historians come to our time, the beginning of the 21st century, 100 years from now, they'll be measuring it not just by the policies of George Bush or by the presidential campaign of Hillary and Barack and John Edwards or Mitt Romney and Rudy Giuliani and Fred Thompson. They'll be measuring our time by our deportment, by our role as citizens, by whether we took the opportunities that were available to us, and they are unparalleled in the world. I can look out at this audience and get a small sense of what the age group is, and I'm not going to ask for a show of hands. But I know, as I look at this audience, how many of you roughly grew up not knowing anyone who had a second home? A second home now is like a second car when I was growing up. It's become routine in a lot of communities. The opportunities to travel, the chance to start your own business, the vitality of this country in so many ways is unparalleled in the history of mankind. And the final analysis, it's the commons, as I describe them, that will define us. What Thomas Jefferson called the common welfare of this country. And we all are responsible for that. So I would hope that as we go back to the 60s and think about them, that the one enduring legacy will be get involved. Step back into the arena. I don't care if you step back on the left side or the right side or in the middle. I'd really like it, personally, if you stepped into the middle and pulled the two sides together. Because we have polarized ourselves in a way. Finally, the best question that was asked to me in the course of writing this book, and we ended up talking to more than 100 people. Well, I'll give you two things. The best question, the best quote. Best question came from Hillary Clinton who said, when I first approached her about participating in the book, have you cracked the code of the 60s yet? And that's a very good line. And I said, no, I don't think it's crackable yet. We're still working our way through it. Just tonight I was on Keith Olbermann because Obama, in his new tack in his campaign, and he said this before, he said, you don't want to go there with Hillary Clinton. She's still fighting the fights of the 60s. I'll take you to a new place. That's a very smart campaign tactic on his part. The second quote that I like so much, out of many that I got from Dick Cheney and Karl Rove and all the people that I talked to, was Arlo Guthrie. Arlo Guthrie said, it's a good thing we're still arguing about the 60s because that means nobody's lost yet. And finally, let me just make this observation about the boomers. I was born in 1940, and so I have 1 foot in the psychedelic water of the 60s and 1 foot on the terra firma and conventional landscape of the 50s. I love being a weekend hippie. I put on my bell bottoms and my sandals, took my kids and went to the Renaissance Fair in Topanga Canyon, and they threw pots with a hippie potter friend of ours, and we'd watch Queen Elizabeth and Whiteface ride through on a horse, you know, and they'd get their faces painted, and we'd buy puka shell necklaces and wear them at home. And Monday mornings, I'd get up and dress like a narc again and go off to work. That's kind of where we all are. Two things. The boomers, who had all this prosperity available to them and privilege, so many of them, pushed back against everything that their parents stood for, rejected their values and their lifestyle, the way that they built their careers. They did this sexually, culturally, politically, and economically. These same boomers are the most tight-ass parents in the history of mankind. They're known as the helicopter parents because they're hovering over their kids. The kids have no breathing space. They go to summer camp for soccer, for music, for piano, for kayaking. Not for macrame anymore. You couldn't stand in the corner and just finger paint. You can't do that. You've got to learn to ride. You've got to take up fencing. You've got to play 3 different instruments. And by the way, you have 2 tutors coming to get you through your SAT scores so we can get you. And you didn't get into your first choice. Where's that principal? I'm going to see them. The same boomers who would go to a concert in Santa Cruz or in Monterey and ingest, inhale, and absorb into themselves anything that was handed to them are now at the Whole Food Market in the organic food section reading only the fine print. I believe the great test of this country, 40 years after the 60s, is to decide what was useful, what's good for society, what we should leave behind. And most of all, I believe, as we go into 2008 and beyond, that we should find a way to have our differences during the day and between 6 and 10 o'clock at night, find common ground to start the next day on. Because the challenges before us are monumental. We're living on a smaller planet with many more people. We have profound climate change underway. We have competition we didn't have in the 60s rising out of Asia. We have Islamic rage around the world that is real, that can't be solved militarily alone by any means. We need a new paradigm for dealing with that. And once again, I believe it's up to all of us. Now, the question that may be on your mind, yes, I did inhale. Thank you all very much.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.